The opposition to the mining practice of fracking, that is, using high-pressure water to fracture rock to access gas or oil, is steadily marching south. Several busloads of farmers, mostly from Gippsland in eastern Victoria, travelled to Melbourne last week with an anti-fracking petition to be tabled in Parliament. More than 400 protesters marched with the Lock the Gate Alliance from City Square to the State Library. Farmers fear fracking would lead to contamination of the underground water table, which in turn will contaminate their land, crops and animals. Kath Sullivan was at the demonstration and this is who she met.
Oh, hello, my name's Hannah Elkier. I actually live in Poowong in Gippsland and I'm here at the City Square today just to try and let the Melburnians know the great risk that our food bowl Gippsland is in because of coal seam gas, coal and coal seam gas mining.
Fracking's been permitted in Queensland and New South Wales. State governments there obviously don't think there's a problem with fracking. What science do you have that these governments don't have that makes you oppose what they're doing?
Oh, Kath, I do believe that they know as much as we do how risky and how bad it is. I don't know if I've already said, but there are 350,000 hectares of exploration licences that the state government have sold. So as you can see, they're making lots of money and money talks.
Yeah, Dan Caffrey, I'm from Traralgon. I'm secretary of the Trove Valley Sustainability Group. Down here to just support. I'm from a farming background too. I know all about the issues. I just want to keep this absolutely poisoning industry out of the good agricultural land.
You come from the Latrobe Valley, which for so long, you know, the mining sector has driven the economy, it's put jobs into the community, it's put money into the community. How can you be so sure that if we're to mine these different gases, that won't be good for the community?
If we taint our aquifers and we get tainted food, that's the end of our export industry, especially to places like China.
But that's not proven yet.
There has been contaminated milk in the USA. Vermont, the dairy state of America, has banned, I think that was in May 2012, banned fracking, which means the end of their coal seam gas industry over there. And they did that because of the thought that it would contaminate the, you know, from the aquifers, which we know that happens, and get into the milk supply. So why would we want this industry in Gippsland?
Hands off sea spray! Hands off sea spray!
Barry Hasem, Merbau North.
Why have you come down today?
I believe most of these politicians have got their snouts in the trough and they keep claiming that they want to have more research. You only have to have a look around the world. Look around in Australia, what's happening. They don't need any more research.
And your banner has a pretty clear message for the Victorian government. Do you want to tell the listeners what it says?
It's got quite clearly written here, frack off Ryan and you to Reith. Now, Reith has been appointed by Napthine government to come and basically write a report on this coal seam gas. That report from Peter Reith, he attended the meeting, he listened to one speaker, then he got the eye of the Channel 9 news down there, went outside, had a talk and left. Didn't even bother to stay for the whole meeting.
Sorry, which meeting is that?
That was the meeting we had at Merbau North against fracking, etc. Had experts down to speak on the subject and Reith didn't even have the decency to wait and hear all of the speakers. I liken it to probably a Roman soldier being asked to give a report on the safety of the lions in the Colosseum. Absolute rubbish. And that's what we're going to get from Reith.
Gina, go home! Gina, go home!
Dawn Stubbs. I'm from the from Munro, actually, halfway between Stratford and Bairnsdale.
I can see you've put a lot of effort into the banner you've brought to Melbourne today. Do you want to tell everyone what it says?
It's got Gina Rinehart holding an awful lot of money and it says Gina and Lakes Oil frack off.
Lakes Oil would love to tell you how much money they've spent in the community and how they've helped to bring business and jobs and money into the community.
I think Esso tries to tell the same story too, which is really interesting because I think it's really kind of blackmail money. I do know that Lakes Oil actually tried to give the Sea Spray School money, but they refused it. And no one's really talking about the wildlife. I mean, they're going to go into national parks as well.
Do you think that walking down the middle of Swanston Street today is going to change anything?
We can only hope, and we're prepared to put down the good fight, that's for sure.
Some of the protesters at a Lock the Gate Alliance anti-coal seam gas rally in Melbourne. Just about everyone in agriculture agrees something's got to give. Farmers just aren't being paid enough to produce food. The general thinking for the past few decades has been to get big or get out. That is, farmers should buy more land to get the economies of scale. Mike McCallum has thrown that argument on its head. He's a futurist, that is, a creative thinker, who comes up with concepts that may just point us in the direction of finding solutions. I asked Mike why there's so little appreciation of what farmers do.
Well, Libby, with respect, I think that's the wrong question. What I see, in fact, is that the people who are involved in food production are engaged in five or six quite different value chains. And if we don't separate those value chains out, then we have conversations that I think are very frustrating for everybody. So,
what do you mean by value chains?
Yeah, so for example, the people who are involved in what I would call large-scale industrial production, what we have said is the epitome of food production.
So for instance, a large grower of wheat.
The second group that we have are what I would call traditional family farms. So these are not the farms that have gone to that large scale.
Which actually make up the majority of farms.
They do. And many of the drivers for those people are quite different. And what we now have to do, in my view, is reconnect the people who produce like that with the consumers. And
how
then
do you
drive
do that, though?
Backwards.
What do you mean by connect the family farmer to the consumer?
Well, I think there are a couple of very good examples around right now. In East Gippsland, there is a thing called a food produce aggregator. And this is where smaller scale producers, and including a couple of food processors, have collected together and, if you like, produced a basket of goods that they can provide. What they're now doing is going into markets, and I know, for example, they went to Jakarta, and saying to the high-end customers in Jakarta, tell me what it is that you want, and then we will reorganise ourselves, improve our logistics chains to deliver exactly on what you want. It's a fundamental shift. It's from a supply-push model, which comes out of the 20th century, to a demand-driven model, which comes out of the technologies of the 21st century.
You also say we need to get away from the unit cost to the whole system cost. But if I'm a farmer and I am doing everything I can to get the most out of what I produce, how do I apply that to what I'm doing?
Well, I think, again, it's about where you put your focus. If you look at the current value flows, and it doesn't matter which of these large flows I'm talking about, what you'll find is that there are certain actors in the system who are doing very nicely, thank you very much. The seed companies are very profitable. The fertiliser companies always recover their costs, and farmers know what that means. And the people who transport and who are distributing also take their costs. In fact, the only people in the current flow that can't pass on costs are the actual producers. So what I would argue, in fact, is that if we start looking at these value flows, we can find that there are serious efficiencies to be gained throughout the system, as well as efficiencies in production as well.
Okay. Let's get down to a more practical level then. You've mentioned this group in East Gippsland. Now, presumably that area has sufficient diversity of agriculture to be able to say to a group of consumers, tell us what you want, we'll supply it. What if where you're farming is only really good at producing one particular thing? How do you apply this model to that? Or you may be just good at producing one particular thing.
Yeah,
doesn't really matter, does it?
Look, I think that's the question. And again, if you look at the history of the last 50 years, in fact, what we've done is we've driven diversity out of the system and we've favoured more and more monocultural approaches. That's good as long as those monocultures, in fact, are delivering for you. But if something goes wrong, then you're in serious trouble.
Well, wool would be the classic.
Well, wool, of course. And what's interesting is that while wool as an idea is no longer an industry, there are you know, many niches which are very profitable. And those people who have been able to identify their niches have done very well, thank you very much. So that's the difference. So in this future, that we need to shift away from monocultures towards increasing diversities.
And you think that's also environmentally a better outcome?
For sure. Because we now need to produce food production systems for a climate-changed world. Look, these are very practical conversations that have to happen in every region, around every kitchen table, where producers can sit down and say, if this kind of variation is the future normal, what is it that I can produce that is really, really smart, given that I've been listening to customers? And it mightn't be what they've ever produced before.
I guess so. If every farmer found the niche, it's no longer a niche. That's the thing. Once everyone gets onto it.
Again, what we're seeing is, and it's a shift in the way that our whole world is going. In the 20th century, it was a mechanistic world that rewarded large-scale efficiency because that was based on cheap oil. The future will reward hundreds of thousands of niches, wherever they may be. And so what I think we'll see is, in fact, an increasing fragmentation. And again, that will make, you know, that words like industry will no longer apply.
Where does that leave a farmer who, let's face it, the average age of a farmer in Australia is late 50s? Listening to that, they're thinking that if this incredible psychological shift has to take place, these really difficult conversations have to be had. I'm only going to be doing this for another decade, perhaps two. Do I need to go there? Can I just keep doing what I'm doing?
Well, Libby, I think this is about the kind of legacy you want to leave in the world. And I think that's the question for an older farmer. It's probably the question for a younger farmer as well. We have to make a transition to a better system, because if we don't, the back half of the 21st century looks, I think diabolical. I think there will be many people globally starving. So in a way, the shift in food will define the kind of society we want to create in the 21st century. I would hope that every farmer would say, I would like my grandchildren to know I was one of those who created a better system. It actually creates better communities, it creates better economies than the sorts of ones we've got now, which I think have disempowered producers.
Futurist Mike McCallum. And that's it for another week of Country Breakfast. If you'd like to have a look at some of the fabulous photographs taken for today's stories, or if you want to look at the news, perhaps even listen back to a podcast of the program, it's all available for you on our website, abc.net.au/rural. Lovely having you in company this morning, and thanks to our technical producer, John Jacobs. On RN, I'm Libby Price. Talk to you soon.